This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Let Freedom Ring. Winning the War of Liberty Over Liberalism by Sean Hannity. Read for you by the author.
All right, first things first. I'm a New Yorker. It's not just home. This is who I am. I was born and raised here. I grew up on Long Island in Franklin Square. I went to Catholic schools for 12 years here. I'm a New Yorker in every way. I was born combative. I love soubrette hot dogs. I have a thick accent, which I didn't really realize until I began to travel in my early 20s around the country when I started living in places like Rhode Island, California, Alabama, and Georgia. But I came back to the Big Apple because my roots are here. It's where I've chosen to settle down with my wife, Jill, raise my kids, and make my career. I love New York. I love every cliche about this wild, wacky, wonderful city. And they're all true. Sure, it's loud and brash and bright and gritty. Sure, everyone here thinks he lives at the center of the universe. So what? We do. People don't dream all their lives of escaping the hellish countries they live in, of paying their life savings to underworld types for the privilege of being locked up in a filthy, freezing, stinking container ship and hauled like cargo for weeks until they arrive in Moscow, Beijing, Baghdad, or Kabul. People risk their lives to come here, to New York, the greatest city in the world where dreams become reality. Now, why shouldn't they? It's a city of immigrants and indigents, busboys and billionaires, big dreamers and big idiots, every race and every religion, every idea and every ism. They're all here competing for your time, attention, and your money. And Sinatra was right. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Now, this is the place where all your dreams are coming true. Welcome to New York, City of Dreams. As much as I love New York, though, on a deeper level, I am a proud American. I believe in the American dream, the American ideal, the unique American culture, and traditional American values. Indeed, my core political beliefs, my conservative ideals, are grounded in my respect for the traditions that make up America's foundation. At the core of those traditions was the idea of freedom. Freedom was the idea that inspired our founders, that moved them to break free of an oppressive regime and envision a better system of government. The framers of our Constitution were determined to establish a governmental structure that would ensure freedom. They understood that freedom was the exception rather than the rule in world history, and they were determined to right that wrong. But the framers also recognized that democratic participation in government wouldn't be enough, for even a parliament could become corrupt in the absence of restraints on government. So in order to safeguard liberties, they knew they would have to impose limitations on government. Limitations that would be etched in a permanent, though amendable, constitution, and would be bolstered by a complex scheme of checks and balances among the various levels and branches of government. At heart, American conservatives like myself are believers in the Constitution. We believe that the principles embodied in the Constitution are enduring and that to whatever extent we deviate from them, we put our liberties at risk. Our views are consistent because we believe in absolute truths and in the essential soundness, even righteousness, of the founders' vision of government. Now, I'm going to talk about a wide array of issues, from perennial questions like education, government spending, and abortion, to the many great urgent concerns that have been raised in this uncertain time, when we face a threat from an elusive and powerful new enemy. Now, if you watched me on Hannity and Combs or listened to the Sean Hannity Show on the radio, you already know that you're in for strong opinions. But if you listen carefully, you'll notice how often my beliefs come back to the basic idea that as Americans, we have a basic right to enjoy freedom in our lives, including the freedom from government interference. For the first time in generations, Americans are now forced to confront an immediate and genuine threat to our way of life. And for me, this is the strongest reason that we must win the war on terror to secure, in those unforgettable words, the blessings of liberty. The conservative vision is that America returned to its founding principles because these principles are the pillars of freedom. Without them, America will not continue to be great. With them, there is no limit to our future. Monday, September 10th, 2001. Well, that's the day my radio show became nationally syndicated. And we talked about cutting taxes, reforming education, strengthening the military, and defending Judeo-Christian values, which are too often being driven out of our schools. And I thought it was a great first day, fun, fast-paced. I was doing what I love, debating the hot news and burning issues of the day. When it was over, I went to sleep happy. The next day, I woke up. John Gomez, a friend of mine since third grade. He called me at home a few minutes before 9 Tuesday morning, September the 11th. He told me a plane had just crashed into the side of one of the World Trade Center towers. He thought it may have been a small commuter plane. It wasn't quite clear at that time. Well, I couldn't believe it. At first, I thought he was kidding. And right away, I turned on the Fox News channel just in time to see the second jumbo jet slam into the side of the second tower and erupt into a monstrous ball of fire and thick black smoke. How could this be happening? This was clearly no mistake, but most certainly a kamikaze. And without a doubt, it was an act of terrorism. Indeed, it was an act of war. It was a moment of incomprehensible horror for every American and for freedom-loving people around the globe. But as a New Yorker, I was seeing more than just an attack against America. For me, this was personal. Some sick cell of psychotic suicide bombers had just attacked my world, my city, my friends. And as I stared at the video replays, at the planes and the people and the terror and the devastation, I knew I was staring right into the face of evil, glimpsing a vision born in the minds of savages. And I knew that, unlike the atrocity at Pearl Harbor 60 years before, the miracle of 21st century communications would soon be bringing the same horrific vision to a billion people all over the world. The experience was as disorienting as it was surreal. Then came word of smoke at the Pentagon. Another plane, another attack. A plane crash near Pittsburgh. A car bomb in front of the State Department, a rumor that later proved false. Air Force One's destination was unknown. The White House was being evacuated. Members of Congress were being rushed to secure undisclosed locations. Then the ghastly image of one tower collapsing. Then the other. People jumping from the towers, running for their lives. A city of smoke and a skyline scarred forever. Hell was breaking loose, and it was all just the beginning. I was due on the air in just a few hours, but there was no way I was going to be able to make it to the studios in Manhattan. New York was under siege. It was locked down by the military. F-16s were flying combat air patrols overhead. I'd have to do my show from a studio on Long Island. So in my mind, I'm saying, what am I going to say? What was happening? What might happen next? Welcome to New York, city of nightmares. On September 11, 2001, the world changed forever. Yours changed and mine changed. When I think back a year later to those horrifying images, to those huge passenger jets filled not only with thousands of pounds of jet fuel, but with the fathers and mothers and sons and daughters to those twin towers, home of some 55,000 workers every day, engulfed in flames, collapsing in mushroom clouds of smoke and dust and ash, to those human bodies raining from the sky, to the frantic, desperate 24/7 search for the 3,000 souls who perished, to all those policemen and firemen, New York's finest, New York's bravest, weeping uncontrollably for their lost brothers, to all those children sitting in classrooms all over New York, all over the country, orphaned, frightened, and alone, to the brave, stoic, heartbroken Ted Olson, the U.S. Solicitor General, at the memorial service for his wife, Barbara. When I see these images, even a full year later, I get angry. I get angry because I'm convinced those attacks might have been prevented. I get angry because I'm convinced the Clinton-Gore administration, they never truly focused on protecting the American people from terrorism in general, and Osama bin Laden in particular. I get angry because it is now clear that President Clinton's sworn obligation to preserve, protect, and defend this nation took a backseat to his personal and political pursuits. Instead of leading an all-out war against those whose express goal was to murder innocent Americans, he wasted precious time and resources fighting with federal prosecutors, federal courts, and the Republican Congress over sins and crimes that he'd committed. And I get angry. For decades, the left in America has foolishly and relentlessly attacked and undermined the very policies and institutions that have made our country a beacon of freedom and prosperity. Instead, they have wasted decades bitterly attacking conservatives as extreme and dangerous, conservatives whose mission it has been to stand up for the rule of law, free enterprise, limited government, and a strong military. And I'm amazed that so many liberals, so many people on the left still don't get it. They still don't seem to grasp the very real dangers we face or what we need to do about them. From the moment those two planes hit those two towers, it was crystal clear to me America is at war. Not an old, cold, communist war, but a new, hot, holy war. Not against an evil nation, a regime with a capital, an army, a navy, an air force, but against an evil network that is wealthy, stealthy, and extremely deadly. To win, we must fight with bullets, bombs, spy satellites, special ops, and the latest weapons in our high-tech, high-intelligence arsenal. But we must also understand that this is also now a war of ideas. It's between good and evil, between right and wrong, between the Judeo-Christian values upon which this country was founded and the violent tenets of radical Islam. And make no mistake, it's winner take all. The shadowy, clandestine forces arrayed against us will not slow their progress until they have decapitated our leaders, destroyed our freedoms, and ushered in a new age of slavery and darkness unless we stop them with deadly force. Even now, as they have been for years, they are feverishly pursuing weapons of mass destruction, and when they have them, they will use them. Our enemies have not been distracted or softened by the allure of modern liberalism, feel-good feminism, or radical environmentalism. They are not distracted from their murderous mission by absurd notions of political correctness. They are focused, they are fearless, and they are disciplined, and they will pay any price to advance their jihad until they win or die, period. We now, therefore, face two fundamental questions. First, are we Americans truly prepared to fight this new war to wipe out terrorism and terrorist regimes and win it decisively, no matter what sacrifice it requires, no matter how long it takes? Now, you might think the answer is obvious, yes. But the fact is, just months after September the 11th, liberal politicians and opinion makers were already seeking to tie President George Bush's hands by publicly announcing their opposition to a much-needed defense spending increase and demanding endgame strategies for a war whose end could not now be known. And they did this while our courageous servicemen and women were defending our country on the battlefields and in the caves of Afghanistan and elsewhere. Unfortunately, this is nothing new. During the Reagan administration, the left opposed modernization of our aging bomber fleet, a 600-ship navy, the modernization of nuclear missiles in Europe, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and our efforts to uproot communism in this hemisphere, including the liberation of Grenada and support for the freedom fighters in Nicaragua. They mocked Reagan for denouncing the Soviet Union as an evil empire rather than condemning the Soviet Union for being an evil empire. The left may be sincere, but they're sincerely wrong. They must be challenged and, in my view, defeated if we are to win this war on terror and preserve our way of life for this and future generations. Second, are we once again prepared to teach our children the fundamental principles and values that make this country great, the values that make this country worth fighting for, living for, and dying for? Far too many liberals see no connection between values, education, the moral health of our nation, and America's security and prosperity. That's precisely the problem. For the past half century, liberals have been engaged in a dangerous and destructive effort to morally disarm our children. Here, too, they must be confronted and defeated if America is to lead and succeed in the 21st century. Now, whether the issues are social, cultural, economic, or international, every significant policy debate and every election of consequence from this point forward will be weighed against the events of September 11th, 2001. Let me put it bluntly. For those who have so long and fiercely opposed giving our military and intelligence forces the tools they need to defend our nation and defeat our enemies, it's now time to answer in the court of public opinion. Why should their message prevail any longer? Why should we entrust our country's future to those whose track record is so miserable? So, too, it's time for those who disparage and dismiss the importance of faith, family, and the flag in our lives to be held account. Liberals preach that there's nothing wrong with the American educational system, that more money in social engineering, fewer standards, and less competition can't solve. They teach our children multiculturalism rather than American culture, revisionist history rather than American history, the thinly disguised religion of secular humanism and extreme environmentalism rather than capitalism. They train our young to criticize America, not to celebrate it. They welcome condoms into the classroom but ban God and the Ten Commandments. They encourage tolerance for the teachings of the Quran but not for the teachings of Jesus Christ. They oppose the Pledge of Allegiance, tell us that God is dead, that Christianity is for losers, that evangelical and Catholic conservatives are more dangerous than radical Islamic militants. They tell us that fuel-burning SUVs are bad for America, but flag-burning SOBs are not. but they're wrong. And it's time to ask why, particularly in time of war, should we entrust the education of our children to people who loathe and ravage so many of our core values and traditions? The views of the American left and the policies that flow from them aren't just wrong-headed, they're reckless. Let me be clear. Liberal ideas are not responsible for the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. They are, however, responsible for making America more vulnerable, for creating confusion in our society and among our children about what is right and wrong, and thus for placing our freedom and security at risk. If the left succeeds in gaining and retaining more power, the well-being of future generations will be at a greater peril. I fear they will inherit a nation that is less free and less secure than the nation we inherited from the last generation. It is therefore our job to stop them, not just debate them, but defeat them in the arena of ideas. Please understand, I'm not saying that liberals like Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Tom Daschle, Dick Gephardt, and many of the elitists in academia and the media are evil. I'm saying they have a disturbing habit of winking at evil, of ignoring it, or turning a blind eye to it. And in doing so, they put all of us in jeopardy. In the weeks and months following September the 11th, Americans began asking hard questions. Wasn't there any way these attacks could have been prevented? Why didn't the CIA know what was coming? How could we spend billions of dollars on intelligence and have such a massive failure? After all, the rising threat of global terrorism, particularly the threat of Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda terrorist network, has been clear to the U.S. and U.S. policymakers for years, from the 1988 bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, to the 1998 bombings of two American embassies in East Africa, to the suicide attack on the USS Cole in the fall of 2000. From the beginning, President Bush expressed the outrage of the American people. He immediately took charge, and there was no mistaking who was commander-in-chief. He made clear that his first priority would be to hunt down the evildoers and bring them to justice. He and his team also made clear that determining the causes of America's security failures and finding its weak points and remedying them would be central to their mission. Other Republicans concurred. Quote, I absolutely believe that we have to go back and see what happened, said Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican, on NBC's Meet the Press just 1 month after the attacks. He stressed the importance of determining what went wrong, quote, so that we will not make the mistakes again that we made before and can reorganize our intelligence services, unquote. Curiously, however, liberal Democrats, many of whom historically criticized, attacked, and sought to defund the CIA, at first showed little interest in an investigation of the roots of this massive intelligence failure. It was only after they smelled political advantage that they began to jump on that bandwagon. Quote, we don't need a witch hunt now, or certainly not next year in an election year, Representative Jane Harman, a California Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, told the New York Times. A witch hunt? Well, that's pretty strong language. What might Representative Harman fear that the American people might learn, especially in an election year? Maybe this, that the Clinton-Gore administration, starting with the president and vice president themselves, had turned a blind eye to the growing threat posed to Americans by global terrorist networks. And it cost us, big time. On December 30, 2001, New York Times reporters Judith Miller, Jeff Gerth, and Don Van Atta Jr. wrote a 7,237-word story titled, quote, Planning for Terror but Failing to Act. The story detailed how the Clinton-Gore administration did little or nothing to crack down on terrorism in the wake of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. The Times story revealed, quote, in 1996, a State Department dossier spelled out Mr. bin Laden's operation and his anti-American intentions, but Clinton chose not to act, unquote. The Times reported, quote, in 2000, after an Algerian was caught coming into the country with explosives, a secret White House review recommended a crackdown on potential sleeper cells in the United States. The review warned that the threat of attack remains high and laid out a plan for fighting terrorism, but most of that plan remained undone. The Times even quoted former Clinton senior advisor George Stephanopoulos admitting that the Clinton-Gore administration never gave much attention to protecting the American people from bin Laden and his ilk, despite the growing number of deaths of innocent Americans at the hands of Al-Qaeda operatives. Quote, it wasn't the kind of thing where you walked into a staff meeting and people asked, well, what are we doing today in the war against terrorism? Unquote, said Stephanopoulos. To which I ask, why not? As time passes, other Clinton-Gore advisors and supporters are going on record to describe just how uninterested the president and vice president really were in defending American citizens from the terrorist threat. Dick Morris, for example, smart, clever, now a Fox News consultant. Morris has known Bill and Hillary Clinton for more than two decades. He worked with them during their political days in Arkansas. More recently, he was the chief political strategist for the Clinton-Gore reelection campaign in 1996. That put him at the epicenter of the Clintons' political lives. It now makes him a window into the soul of the Clintons for conservatives like me, who otherwise wouldn't have gotten within 100 miles of the White House inner sanctum. In interviews over the past year on Hannity and Combs and elsewhere, Morris has shed light on some very disturbing aspects of the Clinton-Gore approach to terrorism. And it hasn't been pretty, but it has been instructive. Morris points out that President Clinton, known for his unctuous phrase, "I feel your pain," never visited the site of the 1993 World Trade Center attack, in which six people died and more than 1,000 were injured. Clinton didn't even meet privately with the director of the Central Intelligence Agency for 2 years following that attack. The lack of focus by President Clinton and Vice President Gore on the 1993 bombing caused the investigation to move forward so slowly that the White House had no idea of Osama bin Laden's complicity in the attack until 1996, 3 years after it happened. Even after a bomb exploded at the 1996 Atlanta Olympic Games and 19 American soldiers died in a bombing of a U.S. military barracks in Saudi Arabia, Morris says that President Clinton, quote, seemed curiously uninvolved in the battle against terror, unquote. This curious inattention wasn't just the result of negligence, which would have been bad enough. Sandy Berger, then President Clinton's deputy national security advisor, quote, seemed to work overtime at opposing tough measures against terror, says Morris. And according to Morris, Berger advised Clinton to veto a bill designed to cripple the Iranian funding of terrorism by mandating American retaliation against companies that aided its oil industry. Berger said that Clinton should only sign the bill if a provision were added that would authorize the president to waive the retaliatory sanctions. And yet Morris observes, though the bill eventually passed with the waiver provision, Berger nevertheless blocked the imposition of sanctions almost every time. To make matters worse, neither President Clinton nor Vice President Gore did much to fight for stronger airline security, despite the rising terrorist threat. Clinton essentially ignored recommendations to X-ray screening for baggage, to restore air marshals to commercial flights, to federalize air security checkpoints. Similarly, Gore did nothing to implement those suggestions when his Commission on Air Safety issued its recommendations in 1997. Only after September 11th, observed Morris, were any of these initiatives instituted. Clinton was apparently so afraid of being accused of racially profiling Islamic charities that he even refused to create a list of extremist and terrorist organizations along with their members and donors in order to alert the public to the possibility of donations that might further terrorism. What conclusion does the man who was once President Clinton's chief political strategist draw from observing these facts? Quote, everything was more important to Clinton than fighting terrorism, says Morris. Political correctness, civil liberty concerns, fear of offending the administration supporters, Janet Reno's objections, considerations of cost, worries about racial profiling, and in the second term, surviving impeachment, all came before fighting terrorism. Now, liberals argue that the administration had many issues to deal with, not just terrorism, and that some things were bound to fall through the cracks, particularly with the rabid Republicans trying to impeach the poor man. That's the pathetic case left-wing filmmaker Michael Moore, author of the book Stupid White Men, a vicious screed against conservatives like President Bush, among others, tried to make to me one night on Hannity and Combs. Quote, frankly, I don't think we're handling this war on terrorism in the correct way, Moore objected. What did we have, 200 FBI agents doing 2, 3, 4 years investigating of the president's zipper? Seriously, think about this. Not his zipper, I shot back. His lying under oath, just to remind you, his lying. He put his hand on a Bible, Michael. Let's see, Morris snapped back. His lying under oath. Or would I rather have 200 FBI agents finding the terrorists who are planning to kill 3,000 people? Well, that's clever of Michael Moore. Oh, so clever. Just one problem. It turns out we didn't need 200 FBI agents tracking down the terrorist mastermind. Sudan actually offered Osama bin Laden to the Clinton-Gore administration on a silver platter. That was back in 1996. Before he bombed our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, before bin Laden attacked the USS Cole, before thousands of Americans died on September 11, 2001, but the Clinton-Gore administration repeatedly turned down Sudan's offer And in doing so, they let Osama bin Laden slip away to unleash an epic of evil against us. In fact, on February 2002, my co-host Alan Combs and I had an opportunity to talk with the man who tried to broker the deal between the Sudanese and the Clinton-Gore White House to deliver bin Laden to the U.S. and put him in our custody, the deal the administration turned down. His name is Mansour Ijaz, and his story is remarkable. Now, Ijaz is an American citizen, a Muslim, a Democrat, and a financial contributor to the Democratic Party and the Clinton-Gore campaigns. The chairman of a New York-based investment company, Ijaz counts among his partners former CIA Director James Woolsey, retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General James Abrahamson, the former director of President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. Ijaz is now a Fox News Channel foreign affairs analyst, but during the 1990s, he was a middleman deep inside the Middle East. Quote, in February of 1996, Ijaz told me, the Sudanese had come to the conclusion that their Islamic experiment had gone bad, essentially that the fanatics had gotten out of control. Bin Laden was a part of that problem. They offered Saudi Arabia an extradition treaty, extradition of bin Laden. Now, the Saudis turned them down, he said, and they came to the United States and said, do you guys want him? And the Clinton-Gore administration said, quote, no, we don't have a case. We can't do it now. Clinton turned it down, I pressed, unsure that I had heard him correctly. They turned it down, he confirmed, adding that the U.S., quote, made a huge mistake in not nabbing bin Laden when we could. After all, he noted, Saddam was the place in which all this Islamic extremism was born. Between 1996 and 2000, Ijaz opened unofficial back channels between Sudan and the Clinton-Gore administration, and he met with Clinton National Security Advisor Sandy Berger and explained that the Sudanese president wanted terrorism sanctions against Sudan lifted. He was therefore offering to arrest and extradite Osama bin Laden to the United States and provide detailed information about global terrorist networks run by Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and Hamas, including information about the two hijackers who would eventually pilot the planes that slammed into the World Trade Center. But to Ijaz's astonishment, the Clinton-Gore administration wasn't interested. In fact, Sudan kept offering important information on bin Laden and top al-Qaeda operatives, but the Clinton-Gore administration kept turning it down, first in 1996 in February, and then in August, and then in April of 97, also in February of 98, and finally in July of 2000, a little over a year before the attacks. In the days after Ijaz first revealed the substance of these foiled negotiations, former Clinton-Gore officials, including former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger and former UN Ambassador Bill Richardson, came forth to dispute them. But their contentions that there was no proof of the story, that Saudi Arabia may have been intending to act as a go-between, rang hollow. The more plausible story is the more regrettable one, that the administration chose not to pursue the opportunity because they still treated bin Laden as a criminal threat, not a terrorist enemy, and feared that they would have no legal grounds to hold him pending a trial. It's truly astonishing. Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and their liberal allies on Capitol Hill were offered Osama bin Laden by the Sudanese government, and they turned that offer down. Now, they could have taken him into custody and begun unraveling his terrorist network almost 6 years ago, but they didn't. And now more than 3,000 innocent Americans have paid with their blood. Why is the left so contemptuous of our military and intelligence services, yet so ignorant of those who would do us harm? I want you to begin to see the pattern and understand what is at risk if misguided liberal ideas continue to distract our nation and drain our national resolve. Next time, it may not be hijacked planes and traces of anthrax powder. It could be a suitcase bomb with radioactive material. It could be a tactical or intercontinental ballistic missile armed with biological, chemical, or nuclear warheads. It could be attacks of apocalyptic proportions, attacks aimed at obliterating our civilization as we know it, unless we act decisively. Quote, the militant Islamic terror that we're facing sees the United States as the main enemy. Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told me on Hannity and Combs just weeks after the September 11th attacks. In their desire to reverse the course of Western history over the last 1,000 years, they view the U.S. as being the West. So they're going to attack America again and again. And the great danger that we face, and I say this every time I'm here, and I'll say it again tonight, he said, If they acquire nuclear weapons, if any part of this terror network acquires nuclear weapons, they will use it. Other nations may decide not to join us in our war on terrorism, Netanyahu warned, but we must not be deterred. Even if at first we must go alone, eventually our moral position will win the day and the world's other democracies will be compelled to join us. The very freedom the terrorists were trying to extinguish would ultimately impel us to victory over them and deliver us security in the future. But having the military power to crush the terrorists, he warned, would not be sufficient. We would also need to muster the will. Words of wisdom in an age of liberal confusion. It was an intense, dramatic, televised showdown between Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and the liberal, Democratic-controlled U.S. Congress over how to wage and win the war against terrorism that actually pushed me off the sidelines and into these war of ideas. It was the summer of 1987. I was living in California trying to make money so I can get myself back into college, but after 2.5 years there, I had run out of money, so I was painting and doing construction, doing some home remodeling. But suddenly, I became engrossed in the televised Iran-Contra hearings. And I was appalled at the unbelievable, vicious liberal attacks on somebody I viewed as honorable and patriotic, a guy by the name of Colonel Oliver North, somebody like Admiral John Poindexter, and the entire Reagan administration, including Reagan himself. Let's not forget what was driving these men, not the quest for their own power or the acquisition of money, but the noble pursuit of the cause of freedom for the oppressed in our own hemisphere. The Monroe Doctrine meant something to President Reagan. They were trying to drive the Sandinista communists from power in Nicaragua. But what soon became painfully evident, the left's goal was to destroy the Reagan administration and drive the president from office. The liberals were dead wrong in their condemnation of U.S. policy. Oliver North and Ronald Reagan, they were right. Evil people and regimes threatened Americans then as they do now, and the Reagan administration was absolutely determined to do something about it, whether that led to the Middle East, North Africa, or Central America. Did they make some mistakes? Maybe. But we were engaged in a Cold War against the evil empire and a hot war against terrorism all over the world. Ollie North, decorated for courage and bravery in Vietnam with the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, 2 Purple Hearts, 3 Navy Commendation Medals, helped plan the Reagan administration's liberation of Grenada. He helped plan the raid against Libya in response to repeated rounds of Libyan terrorism. He helped the president wage a relentless campaign for freedom and democracy in Central America. And for his efforts, Ollie and his family were not heralded as American heroes. They were targeted first by Libyan terrorists and then by liberal Democrats. These hearings had a profound impact on my life. I found myself getting furious at the sight of congressmen and senators excoriating a dedicated patriot like Ollie. I was so riveted by the Iran-Contra hearings that I wouldn't go to work. I'd stay home. I'd watch the hearings all day. I even taped them so I could watch them over again. I still have copies to this day. The more I watched and listened, the angrier I got. And in my search to express my views, to hear a different viewpoint on the subject from what was available on TV, well, I began calling into radio talk shows to defend Ollie North and beat up on the sanctimonious congressmen and senators. Their attacks on the CIA and covert operations and the Reagan administration's policy of peace through strength, I argued, would end up damaging our national security and making all Americans more vulnerable to attack. As it turns out, Ollie was way ahead of the curve on the question of terrorism and the dangers of foreign aggression. Had we listened to him then, I am convinced America would be less vulnerable to attack today. And somewhere along the way, I found my calling in life. Now, let me say this before I go any further. My quarrel with liberals and liberalism is not personal. Just because I think liberals are wrong on the issues doesn't mean I don't like them. The vast majority of liberals are good, sincere, well-meaning people. They love their kids, they love their neighbors, and I'm sure most love their country. They're sickened by terrorism, and they certainly don't set out to make our country or our kids more vulnerable to people or policies or ideologies that would do any of us harm. It's just that now, in a post-9/11 world, the stakes are much too high, and the case needs to be made that liberal policies will put all of our freedoms at risk. I certainly don't have any beef with my Fox News partner in crime, Alan Colmes. He's a great guy. He's a great American. Sure, we disagree, but we try hard not to be disagreeable. Yes, some nights he wants to smack me. Some nights I want to smack him. After all, I'm right, and he's wrong. but at least we have fun duking it out with each other. Rank-and-file liberals with big dreams and big mouths, they don't bother me. Why should they? I'm confident in my views. God bless them. Let freedom ring. As we say at the end of our TV show every night, we have our opinions. You are entitled to yours. Debating the issues makes America strong. More power to you. This is America, after all. Whatever you think, you're free to say it out loud as long as you're prepared to defend it. And if you get lucky, as Alan and I have, someday you may even get paid for it. But the question remains, why is it that so many leading liberals seem to think that the real threat to America isn't communism or Islamic radicalism or terrorism, but conservatism? Over and over again in the past decade, rather than deal with the real and rising threat of terrorism and a lethal Islamic jihad, liberals have acted as though American conservatives were members of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Bob Herbert of the New York Times wrote that, quote, the Republican jihad against the poor, the young, the helpless rolls on. Washington Post columnist Mary Magori declared, quote, human sacrifice is much in vogue now. The Republican right thinks that people who get on its nerves, especially women, should be sent to the stake. Allen Ginsberg, the leftist poet of the 1960s, chided, quote, I have no doubt that if Rush Limbaugh or Pat Robertson or Oliver North ever got real power, there would be concentration camps and mass death. What are these people thinking? Can't they disagree with conservatism without being so mean-spirited about conservatives? Well, apparently not, which is ironic when you consider that these same liberals often accuse conservatives of having a monopoly on meanness. Throughout the 1990s, especially after the conservative revolution of 1994 that put the GOP in charge of the House and Senate, such venomous attacks were par for the course. And it wasn't just leftist pundits making these reckless accusations, but also liberal politicians. Those with official power, from whom we should expect a higher standard of responsibility and comportment. But they were determined to use extremist rhetoric to paint Republicans as vicious soldiers engaged in a war against everything sacred in America. President Clinton vilified the conservative Congress, quote, what they want to do, he said, is make war on the kids of this country. Vice President Gore charged that, quote, the Republican leadership in this Congress is conducting a jihad on the environment in the most right-wing agenda we have seen in America this century. Bill Clinton's White House Chief of Staff, Leon Panetta, told the Washington Post that he feared Republicans were poised to launch a, quote, unquote, philosophical jihad. And Representative Martin Frost, a Texas Democrat and one-time chief fundraiser for the House Democrats, he took the image one step further, charging in a campaign letter that Newt Gingrich, quote, is one of the most dangerous figures to emerge in American politics during our lifetime. He calls himself a revolutionary, but he promotes the policies of a terrorist. Few issues seem to evoke more hysteria from the left than when conservatives argue that cracking down on illegal immigration, reforming our deeply flawed immigration and naturalization service, and protecting America's coastlines and borders is essential to defending U.S. national security. As early as 1983, President Ronald Reagan was pointing out, quote, this country has lost control of its borders and that, quote, unquote, no country can sustain that kind of position. The product of a rich and wonderful heritage of Irish immigrants, Reagan was strongly pro-immigration, pro-legal immigration. He celebrated the strength of an America created by men and women in pursuit of freedom, coming from all over the globe to work hard and play by the rules. But Reagan believed that such new Americans must be encouraged to assimilate and become part of the unique American culture, that they should not just live in America in segregated, balkanized enclaves, but actually become Americans. At the same time, he believed that no country could tolerate nor long survive criminals and terrorists sneaking across its borders and burrowing into its society with impunity. The left didn't like such notions of border security then, and they haven't warmed to them since. They spuriously contend that opposing illegal immigration means opposing all immigration. Worse, some of them apparently believe that conservatives are racist for insisting on defending the nation's borders against illegal intrusions. Before going into more detail on this, let me share a bit of my own heritage, which has obviously contributed to the way I see these issues. Now, I have a sign hanging in my office right now. It says, Irish Catholics need not apply. To me, it's a daily reminder that racism is real. Religious bigotry is real. Anti-immigration sentiment is real. Real and ugly. My Irish Catholic family experienced such ugliness, and it's not something that I take lightly. I am a second-generation American and proud of it. My grandparents were all born and raised in Ireland. They came here in the early part of the 20th century. They came by boat. They entered at Ellis Island. They settled in New York. And along with many other immigrants, they carved out a life for themselves against the odds through their industriousness in this land of opportunity. My maternal grandfather, a man by the name of Cornelius Flynn, settled in the Bronx. This man had a tremendous work ethic, and he also had the gift of gab. He was smart, he was funny, he was opinionated. Not a bad legacy, by the way, to leave behind. But during the dark days of the Depression, he didn't let the fact that he was poor, that he was an Irish Catholic immigrant, keep him down. He never regarded his race, religion, or ethnicity as a burden. He considered and proudly claimed them as assets. My grandfather went out every day, made friends with people wherever he could, and in the process, he managed to find jobs all over the city of New York. Then once he'd been working in a job for a while and had earned his employer's trust, he'd ask if one of his family members could take over the job for him. At first, his employers would be surprised, but sure enough, most of them said yes. Then off he'd go to find a new job. In his kindness and his shrewdness, my grandfather battled back racism, helping one Irish Catholic after another find work to feed his family. He told me these stories himself. Along the way, my grandfather taught his family the values he held dear. He made sure that his kids went to the best possible schools. He believed that an immigrant kid with an education could go places in America, and he was right. My mom, Lillian Hannity, she went to school in the Bronx, back when public schools, by the way, in New York were good. She graduated valedictorian of her high school class. She learned to work hard. She saved her pennies. She planned for her future. And in turn, she passed those values on to me and my three sisters. My paternal grandfather, whose name was Hugh Hannity, he was a good man who did his best in very tough times. He settled in the Bed-Stuy section of Brooklyn, a rougher neighborhood than the Bronx. More racism, more violence. His wife, my grandmother, died from complications related to childbirth soon after my father was born in 1925. My dad, also named Hugh Hannity, grew up without much money, without a mother, and his father had to work a lot. He wasn't around much either. My father got shuffled around among relatives a lot. His life was not an easy life. Then came December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the worst sneak attack on American soil in history until 9/11 happened 60 years later. As soon as he could, my father, like all of his friends back then, he signed up with the Navy. He served 4 years, mostly in the Pacific. He didn't really talk much about it when I was growing up. He didn't brag about it. But I got to tell you, I'm proud of my father, and I'm grateful for him. He was the son of immigrants, working shoulder to shoulder with thousands of others just like him, who put their lives on the line for their new country. They knew it wasn't a perfect country, but it surely was a free country. I came to understand why we call such men part of the greatest generation, and I want my kids to understand this someday as well. So many of these men were so new to these shores, yet they instinctively understood the value of freedom, hard work, and sacrifice. They understood that despite America's flaws, she was a force for good in the world, a beacon of freedom, an island of hope in an ocean of tyranny. And they understood deep in their souls that if America went down in flames, the liberties of men and women all over the globe would eventually be lost as well. For America was not just another place to hang their hats. These men hadn't simply come to America, they had become Americans, part of a dream worth living and dying for. After the war, my father came home and he lived that dream. He got a job in the restaurant business. He met and married my mother, moved to Long Island, and just like their parents, my parents put a huge emphasis on education. They sent us to Catholic schools when I was growing up. Sacred Heart Seminary in Hempstead for middle school, and St. Pius X Seminary for high school. They really had to struggle financially, by the way, to do this, and they sacrificed a lot. Why? In part because both were great schools academically, and in part because they were schools that would reinforce the faith, the heritage, and the values they were trying to instill in my sisters and me at home. Even when putting their roots down as full-fledged Americans, my parents never shied away from their Irish Catholic roots. They celebrated them, and we went to Mass every Sunday. I was fortunate. I, in my life, never personally experienced any anti-Irish or anti-Catholic bigotry the way some people have, the way my parents or grandparents did growing up, though they rarely ever spoke of it. My parents' primary concern was for us to know who we were, where we came from, and to be proud of it while learning how to pursue the American dream for ourselves. They wanted us to succeed beyond their wildest dreams. They wanted us to appreciate the freedoms they fought and worked so hard for us to enjoy. And they wanted us to take advantage of those freedoms and to do the best to succeed. No one has to tell me that life isn't easy for people coming to America to make new lives for themselves. Look, I get that because my family lived that. And I believe in my heart and soul that our laws have to protect those who work hard and play by the rules. And it doesn't matter who they are or where they're from or what they look like. It's only fair that we do not discriminate. But you know what? When I look at that sign hanging in my office, Irish Catholics need not apply, I don't get discouraged about the darker time in our country's history. Instead, I am reminded about how far America has come. As I said, I understand we're not a perfect country. We have flaws, we have warts, we have sins. But unlike most countries, we have always been big enough to atone for those sins and make constructive changes. That's one of the many great things about this country. We've had the humility to make adjustments when we didn't like what we saw and what we did. And we continue to move forward, overcoming challenges, making progress. In less than a century, America transformed itself from a place where Irish Catholics and blacks and Jews and dozens of other minorities could barely find work to a society where millions of kids, just like me, Sean Hannity, could succeed beyond what his parents and grandparents ever could have imagined. Just as the left has demonized Republicans on a host of other issues, they have been particularly venal toward the right with respect to their stand on immigration. Instead of constructively contributing to the debate, liberals have used the issue as a racially charged political football. In 1995, a Stanford University professor named Dale Maharaj wrote a blistering article in Mother Jones. He described Pete Wilson, then California's Republican governor, as, quote, a symbol of American racism for wanting to stop the flood of illegal immigrants pouring into California. And he warned of Wilson's skillful manipulation of white fear. And he quoted the Reverend Jesse Jackson describing Wilson as, quote, the new George Wallace, fueling deep racial divisions. And he also charged that Wilson has been chiseling in the dark mine of fear that was El Dorado for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, both of whom had political roots in California. Theirs was a racial message tailor-made for the suburbs. He wrote that, quote, Republicans across the nation have copied Nixon and Reagan's use of the racial wedge issue, particularly on the topic of illegal immigration. This professor's conclusion? Like the ghoul from Friday the 13th movies, Governor Wilson is the Jason of politics. The prognosis is often 6 feet under, but he routinely claws his way out of the soil and does so by standing at the forefront of the old European America and rejecting the new multiracial America. Well, these vicious comments stemmed in part from his political opposition to Governor Wilson's support of Proposition 187, which would have cut health and social services, including access to public education, to illegal aliens and their children. In the politically charged atmosphere surrounding the issue of immigration, you can't have an honest difference of opinion without running the risk that some hardline left-wing critic like this professor will play the race card. And his venom was hardly an isolated case. Writer Bill Berkowitz wrote a piece for The Nation in which he charged that, quote, conservatives are fond of fashioning a connection between immigration and terrorism. Then he tried to smear Pat Buchanan, Texas Republican, Ron Paul, and conservatives in general as part of, quote, white supremacist organizations and an anti-immigrant movement that includes 600 active hate groups, some of which subscribe to a racially charged conspiracy theory. Well, during the 96 campaign, President Clinton clearly insinuated that racism had motivated recent church burnings and the move to curb illegal immigration. Quote, he said, we really fall into a dangerous trap when we start blaming our problems on other people just because they're different from us. He told this to a crowd in San Diego, all but declaring outright that conservative Republicans are racist. He went on to say, quote, I say that because even though I'm a long way from there, my heart has been in the native South for the last several weeks as we have dealt with this incredible rash of church burnings. Vice President Gore, well, he took the same tack when courting Latino voters in the 2000 presidential race by pointing to Republican support of three California ballot propositions. Gore urged Latino voters to take their resentment out against Republicans at the polls for favoring measures on illegal immigration, affirmative action, and bilingual education. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt similarly showed no hesitation about invoking the race issue during the 2000 campaign. Quote, the Republican leadership in Congress, he said, has spent the last 6 years blocking bills, stopping progress, strengthening the anti-immigration forces in the culture and in the country. Terry McAuliffe, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, echoed his contemptible mantra, railing against the, quote, anti-immigration forces in the Republican Party. And Representative Luis Gutierrez, an Illinois Democrat, blasted the, quote, unquote, anti-immigrant proposals put forward by the Republican Party in recent years. Well, the rhetoric never stops, and sometimes its tone gets absolutely out of hand. Senator Ted Kennedy, the party's elder statesman, he agrees, quote, the majority Republican Party, he charged, is basically anti-civil rights, anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-worker. Charlie Rangel, a New York Democrat, has gone as far as to say, quote, a wave of scapegoating is sweeping the country, and that just like under Hitler, people say they don't mean to blame any particular individuals or groups, but in the U.S., those groups always turn out to be minorities and immigrants. The left's anti-conservative rhetoric is damaging, but even worse are the political, opportunistic, and dangerous immigration policies or non-policies that they advocate. Guess how many illegal aliens are in the United States at this very moment? Take a wild guess. 1 million, 2 million, 5 million? Try more than 8 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. today. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in the year 2000, there were 8.7 million unauthorized immigrants living in the USA. That's some 2.5 times the amount when Clinton and Gore were elected. That's 3.4 million when they were elected, to 8.7 million today. And disturbingly, the Census Bureau estimated that in the year 2000, there were 114,818 people from the Middle East living illegally right here in the U.S., and that included some 30,823 illegal aliens from Iran, named by President Bush as part of the Axis of Evil after 9/11. And the Census Bureau information also included 59,623 illegal aliens from Islamic countries such as Afghanistan, then the home base of Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. The majority of these illegal aliens were males. On top of all of this, there was an estimated 2 million foreign citizens who come into the U.S. each year and illegally overstay their visas. All in all, thanks in large part to the Clinton-Gore administration, we have a huge illegal